Good morning. I had a friend of mine. He went to K-State University, and he called me up because he was so excited to go off to college. His goal was to reach his dorm floor for Christ. And so we like talked and made plans, and he, you know, I'm like, here's how you can do it, and here's what I would do if I were you. And like a month into school, he calls me up, spiraling downward in despair. And I'm like, bro, what's going on? He's like, I went potluck with my roommate. I had no idea who he was. He's a Muslim. And I'm like, your roommate's a Muslim? He's like, my roommate is a Muslim. He's like, did you know they pray 5 times a day? I'm like, yeah. He's like, I pray 5 times a month. He's like, did you know they fast for 40 days during daylight hours of Ramadan? I'm like, yeah. He's like, I fasted once in the 8th grade and my girlfriend broke up with me. He said, who am I to say that his way is wrong and my way is right? Who am I to say that I have the corner market on faith when he's more spiritual than I am? And again, that is what we are dealing with today. We are dealing with what happens to the person who through no faults of their own never hears the gospel and dies. What happens to the person who through no faults of their own never hear the gospel and dies, especially when you see other religions? I mean, think about it. We work with Hindus, our doctors are Muslims, and our kids play soccer with Buddhists. The world is here, and how do we interact with them when it comes to our faith? And so one option is to say, oh, whatever you believe is fine for you. Another option is to say, oh no, only Christ saves, but it's not necessary for you to hear the specifics. Another option is to say, no, you must hear the specifics and respond. What happens to the person who through no fault of their own never hear the gospel and dies? I think of my grandmother. She died when I was like 8. She was born in Sesakwa, Oklahoma. She lived in Sesakwa, Oklahoma. She died in Sesakwa, Oklahoma. She never learned to spell it. And I realized, you know what? She never met a Muslim. She never encountered a Hindu because they were not in Sesakwa, Oklahoma when she was growing up. And I was thinking about the difference between my 5 children today and how they'll grow up, where my daughter's learning Arabic and her best friend's a Muslim. And how is she going to interact with these other faiths, and how is it going to affect her? And so again, I just want to talk this morning about what happens to the person who through no fault of their own never hears the gospel and dies. Here's an email I got from Chris. He's from Ohio State University. And see if you can just understand where he's coming from. He sent me this. He says this: I have a question for you. How can others find peace and spirituality in other religions? From observation, I find that Hindus, Muslims, and Buddhists have peace in their religion. The largest religions in the world stress the same basic points. It seems that only those who follow them make such a difference about them, but all their messages are the same. Here Chris is. He's from small town Ohio, and he was taught his whole life, Jesus is the only way. Jesus is the only way. But when he comes face to face with people of other faiths, now he's like, wait a minute. So this morning, I want to give you 3 options to walk out with of where you stand. And I have to believe we have all 3 here this morning. So this morning, when you walk out that door through the construction, I want you to say, okay, there are 3 options that I can have. The first option is you can be considered a pluralist. You can be considered a pluralist. The second option is you can be considered an inclusivist, an inclusivist. And the third option is you can be considered an exclusivist. So I just want to walk you through these 3 this morning. The pluralist, you can be considered a pluralist. The pluralist would say, those who've never heard the gospel, they're not lost. You can be an inclusivist. The inclusivist would say, those who've never heard the gospel, they're not lost. Or you can be an exclusivist, which would say, unless you hear the gospel and respond, you are completely lost. Okay, so those are the 3. That's where the train's going this morning. Pluralist, inclusivist, exclusivist. Let's just talk about all 3. Let's start with the pluralist. The pluralist. Now, one of the key thinkers of pluralism was actually a gentleman from England who had a radical conversion to Christianity. His name is John Hick, and John Hick received Christ and immediately started to have prayer meetings and evangelistic Bible studies. But when he came across people from other faiths, he realized, like this email that I read, that they have peace in their religion. And so he's like, man, maybe the Muslim needs to be a Muslim because he finds joy in Islam. Maybe the Buddhist needs to be a Buddhist because he finds joy in Buddhism, and I need to be a Christian because that is what I have responded to. And so let me just read what a pluralist would believe. A pluralist would say there is a religious ultimate reality called the real, to which all religions are legitimate responses. Now notice, the pluralist would say there's something out there called the real. The pluralist will not acknowledge the word God. They will not say there's something out there called God because 650 million Buddhists deny God, 350 million Confucius deny God, and 250 million Taoists deny God. That's one out of every seven people on the planet. So the pluralist drops the name God and instead says we are all, no matter where you live, groping after this thing called the real. The pluralist continues to say that salvation and transformation are occurring at the same extent across all major religions. You're no closer to the real as a Hindu, as I am a Buddhist, as she is a Jew. The pluralist would say we're all going after the real. Now, one of the favorite stories of a pluralist actually comes from Hinduism. Let me give you the story. And if you took Philosophy 101 in college, you know the story. The story goes like this. A king invites into his court five blind men. Unbeknownst to the five blind men, he places in front of them an elephant. And he says to the five blind men, reach out and touch what you feel and explain it to me. So the first blind man reaches out and he touches the tail and he cries out, it's a rope. The second blind man touches the leg of the elephant and he cries out, it's a tree trunk. The third blind man touches the side of the elephant and he cries out, it's a mud wall. The fourth blind man touches the ear of the elephant and he cries out, it's a banana leaf. The fifth blind man touches the tusk of the elephant and he cries out, it's a sword. And the reason pluralists like this story is it says whatever you're touching is a real experience for you. And so if you're a Christian, you're touching the tail. If you're a Hindu, you're touching the side. If you're a Buddhist, you're touching the ear. Now, obviously, when you encounter these world religions, they all seem a little different only because you're touching different portions of the real. So the pluralists would keep going to say the world's religions provide independent access to salvation. Christianity is just one among many religions and has no unique claim as the final or authoritative truth. This means if you're sitting in here and you're a Christian, the Bible's authoritative for you. But if you're a Muslim, the Quran's authoritative for you. If you're a Buddhist, their holy book called the Dhammapada is authoritative for them. If you're a Hindu, their holy book is called the Bhagavad Gita. That's authoritative for you. Now, imagine if I flew to London and sat down with John Hick, who's a pluralist, who I mentioned. Imagine if I sat down with him in London at my favorite coffee shop. I go there every time I'm in London, Starbucks. And so I sit down with John Hick. I bring my wife, and I say to Mr. Hick, I'm like, Mr. Hick, you are the foremost pluralist in the world. I've read all 30 of your books. You're a prolific thinker and writer. I just have one question for you as a pluralist. What religion are you? I mean, you believe in the real. You believe there is no unique claim to Christianity. And he would say, I'm a Christian. And I would say, Mr. Hick, you're a Christian. And he would say, I'm a Christian. And I would say, you're a Christian. And he would say, I'm a Christian. And I would say, you're a Christian. And he would again say, why are you? I'm a Christian. He would say, I had a salvation experience in college. The Bible's my authority today. And I would say, well, Mr. Hick, if the Bible's your authority, what about John 14:6? I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. John 14:6, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. If the Bible's your authority, what about 1 Timothy 2:5? There is one God and one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. What about Acts 4:12? Salvation is found in no one else except the man, Jesus Christ. And Mr. Hick would begin to laugh. I would share those three verses with Mr. Hick, and he would begin to laugh. And I'd be like, Mr. Hick, why are you laughing? Like, those are some top verses that claim exclusivity in Christ. And he would say, Todd, we've been sitting at Starbucks for 20 minutes and you haven't even introduced me to your wife. Well, that's because I'm frustrated. Well, this is my wife, Jessica. Tell me about Jessica. Tell you about Jessica? Yeah, tell me about Jessica. Well, we've been married for 16 years. We have 5 amazing children. She raises her kids in a godly way. She's the most beautiful woman in the world. And he would say, what did you just say? She's the most beautiful woman in the world. And he would look at Jessica and say, Jessica, when did you win that contest? What continent was it on? And what were your prizes? And I would say, Mr. Hick, what are you talking about? And he would say, Todd, I asked you a simple question. Tell me about your wife. And it wasn't enough for you to say, she's beautiful to me. Instead, you took your language to the fullest and said, she's the most beautiful woman in the world. And when you said that, you did not want me to take you literally because that was not your intention. He would say, Todd, when the Bible speaks of Jesus as the way, the truth, and the life, the Son of God is the only way, it's not to be taken literally. As pluralists, we don't take this literally. We say instead the disciples wrote this, and they used that language to show you how much they loved. And by the way, 73% of Christians in America fall under pluralism. 73%, that's the stat. 73% of Christians think there are multiple paths to God. This is not something they're gonna tell you in the foyer of the church or in Bible studies or in prayer meetings. But ask your friend who's a follower of Christ to engage the nations globally, no thanks. Invite them to pray for the world, no thanks. Invite them to share their faith with internationals around them, no thanks. And all of a sudden you lean in and say, you know what? I think you're not engaged in global missions because you don't necessarily think the lost are lost. And so you can be in here and you can be a pluralist. There are a lot of pluralists. The second option, the pluralist is the first option. The second option is called the inclusivist. The inclusivist. Now let me just read you what an inclusivist would believe. The inclusivist affirms without qualification that Jesus is the definitive and authoritative revelation of God. We like that, right? It's like, yes, the inclusivist would say Jesus is the authoritative revelation of God. The person who we just talked about, the pluralist, would not agree with that statement. The pluralist would say there's many revelations of God. Ram, Krishna, Ganesh, Muhammad, Jesus was one of them. But the inclusivist would say Jesus is the authoritative revelation of God. The inclusivist, the second thing the inclusivist would say is this. The most important event in human history was the death and resurrection of Christ. The inclusivist would say humanity is lost, separated, without hope. And the inclusivist would say the only way you and I can get to heaven is through the death and resurrection of Christ. And again, we like that. We're like, wow, that's incredible. But the point of contention for the inclusivist is they would add one more thing. They would say the death and resurrection of Christ is the most important event in human history. But it's not important that you and I hear about the event in order to be saved. The inclusivist would say, you do not have to hear about Christ in order to receive Christ. Well, man, how do you receive Christ without ever hearing about Christ? Well, let me try to explain it. The inclusivist would say, you don't have to hear about Christ in order to receive the grace that he gives. Because inclusivism 101 says that you and I are only held accountable to the knowledge we possess. Let me say that again. Inclusivism 101 says you and I are only held accountable to the knowledge you possess. So, fly with me to Yemen, meet my Muslim friend Abdullah. Abdullah will never hear the gospel. Abdullah in Sana'a, Yemen, will never own an Arabic Bible. And so how does the inclusivist say that he receives Christ? The inclusivist would say this. If he is true to his religion, that faith in his religion ricochets to the cross, and Jesus sees faith in his religion as receiving him. So what the inclusivist would say is every step the Muslim takes towards the mosque, it's as if he's asking Christ in his life. Every time the Muslim opens the Quran and reads it, Jesus looks down and says, I see that faith. And that faith in Islam ricochets to the cross. Where would the inclusivists go to show this in Scripture? Well, Acts chapter 10. Acts chapter 10 is somewhere that they turn to. If you're an inclusivist, this is where you would turn to. I don't know if you remember Acts chapter 10, but basically, if you remember Cornelius, he had no knowledge of God. Cornelius had no access. He was a Gentile. He had no access to the Torah or the temple or the priest, but yet he cries out to God, and the angel Gabriel says, what is it? Cornelius, your prayers and your gifts to the poor have come up before God. So the inclusivist would say, see, look, in Acts chapter 10, Cornelius just cried out. He had faith in what he had, and that faith ricocheted to the cross. Again, for the inclusivist, they're going to say a person might not know the factual content of Jesus. So if you sit down with a Muslim and say, share Jesus with me, they're going to say, I don't know. But they have responded to God through their faith, whether it's Islam, Hinduism, or Buddhism, Confucianism, or Taoism, or animism. And so they are not called Christians. I would not talk to my friend Abdullah and say, are you a Christian? He would say, no. But the inclusivist would say, if he's a good Muslim, then he's a believer. And in the afterlife, he'll get full knowledge. So your first option when you walk out that door and say, what happens to the person who through no faults of their own never hears the gospel and dies? You can fall under the category of a pluralist, which would say we are all going after the real. Every religion is fine. You can fall into the category of the inclusivist, which has a very high view of Jesus and the death and resurrection, but there is no need to share about Jesus and receive him personally. Or the third category, you can walk out that door and you can be an exclusivist. An exclusivist. Now, the exclusivist agrees with the first point of inclusivism, right? The exclusivist agrees that Jesus is the definitive and authoritative revelation of God. The exclusivist agrees with the second point of inclusivist, which said the most important event that's ever happened is the death and resurrection of Christ. But the exclusivist would go a step further and say, it wasn't enough that that event happened. You actually have to hear the message of salvation, respond by receiving Christ, and you actually have to turn from all your sin. So the exclusivist would take it a step further and say, it's not enough that the event happened of the death and resurrection of Christ. You and I have to actually personally receive it. So let's just pause for a second. Let me give you an illustration or a scenario that will try to drive this deeper into your understanding, okay? So hypothetically, let's say you are a Chinese peasant and you live 200 kilometers outside of Beijing and you will never hear the gospel, you will never meet a Christian, you have no access, but every season you throw your seed down and you watch it grow up and become rice to feed your family. And you say, wow, I didn't cause the rain, the wind, the soil, the sun. And you think something is out there helping me. And so as a Chinese peasant, 200 kilometers from Beijing, you take two strands of incense, you walk 20 kilometers, and you light incense, thanking your ancestors for help. How lost is the Chinese peasant for the pluralist? How lost is the Chinese peasant for the pluralist? And of course, the answer is he's not lost. Because the Chinese peasant for the pluralist is crying out to the real, just like you and I in the West this Sunday morning are in church. How lost is the Chinese peasant to the inclusivist? And again, to the inclusivist, the Chinese peasant is not lost. Because he thinks he's lighting incense to his ancestors, but in reality, that's ricocheting to the cross. And Jesus receives his faith in his ancestors as faith in him. how lost is the Chinese peasant for the exclusivist? And again, it would be completely lost. And unless someone leaves their zip code, flies to Beijing, takes a train 200 kilometers and learns Mandarin and shares the gospel with him, he is headed to a Christless eternity. So the pluralist would say, not lost. The inclusivist would say, not lost. The exclusivist would say, completely lost. And I'm here to tell you, today's game day. So at 3:30, if I came to your house for some cheese curds and we invited your relatives, your aunts, your uncles, and your children, and in the middle of the second quarter when we're up by 14, I just take a pause and say, hey, what happens to the person who through no fault of their own never hears the gospel and dies? I'm going to have all three views at your own house. Oh, now your son won't say, I'm a pluralist. Or your sister won't say, I'm an inclusivist. She won't know those terms, but when she unpacks why she thinks the lost are not lost, you can look at her and say, man, sis, you just defined inclusivism perfectly. So let's evaluate. Let's talk about the problems with some of these perspectives, okay? Let's start. Let's evaluate. Let's start with the pluralist. Why am I not a pluralist? I am not a pluralist because in this view, God becomes gush. What does that even mean? I have no idea what you're talking about, sir. You lost me at your grandmother. Like what? What are you talking about? In pluralism, God becomes gush. Let me just explain that. Let's say you're at Starbucks, you know the good one. Let's say you're at Starbucks, okay, and you're sitting across a table, and it's crowded, like it's really crowded. And so you sit down at this large table, and it's like totally busy. You're looking for a plug. You can't find it. You're bitter. You've got your coffee. You sit down. You squeeze at this large table. You just have no personal space, but you're just going to sit for an hour, and you squeeze, and you sit down, and you put in your Nickelback, and you're trying to drown out the world. You put in your headphones, and you look up from the table. And across from you is a Muslim. Next to him is a Buddhist. Next to him is a Hindu. That almost sounds like the opening to a joke, doesn't it? All right, you're sitting in Starbucks. You got a Hindu, Muslim, and a Buddhist, and the Muslim's like, la, la, la. No. And you're like, oh my goodness, like, this is incredible. Right here, we have this. So you take out your earbuds and you wave at the Muslim because he's wealthy from Saudi, so he's got the Beats cancellation headphones on. And you're like, yes? And you say, are you a Muslim? And he says, yes. And you say, how many gods in Islam? And he says, one. And the Buddhist sitting next to him, who took a vow of poverty, so he's not wearing headphones, he overhears the conversation. And he says, I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt, but actually he's wrong. There is no God. And the Hindu, who's just glad to be anywhere, sitting next to him, is like, actually there are millions. Now, which one for the pluralist is correct? Which view is correct? And the pluralist would have to say they're all correct. And if they're all correct, then none of them are correct, because as soon as you say something about God, someone else says no, and so God becomes gush. God becomes gush. And the problem with the five blind men in the room with the elephant, the problem with that story is the only reason that story makes sense is because of the sixth man in the room. The sixth man in the room is the only reason. He's the all-seeing king, and the all-seeing king says, that's an elephant, let's start the story. I have no problem saying to the pluralist, this is the all-seeing king. And it tells me there is no one righteous, no, not one. We've all gone astray, but the Father initiates salvation by the Son. What do you get when you cross a pluralist with a Jehovah's Witness? What do you get when you cross a pluralist with a Jehovah's Witness? Someone who knocks on your door for no real reason? You're good. I do not know what I'm here for. So I am not a pluralist. The problem with inclusivism is 40 times in the Gospel of John, Jesus says, whoever responds, whoever believes. Jesus gives us, we have to respond. And the inclusivist says, no, you don't. The inclusivist, in this view, salvation comes to the Hindu who loves Krishna, to the Muslim who loves Allah, to the Buddhist who loves Siddhartha Gautama and the holy books there. Faith in your religion saves, and then when you get to the afterlife, you realize, oh my goodness, it was Jesus all along. Again, I'm not an inclusivist. I don't see Paul the Apostle in Acts 17 and when he's like, men of Athens, I say to you, what you worship to an unknown God, keep going. It's ricocheting. No, Paul doesn't say, what you worship to an unknown God, it's getting there, don't worry. No, instead he says, let me give you specifics. Listen to this passage. Whoever believes in him is not condemned. Whoever does not believe stands condemned because he has not believed in the name of God's only Son. Think about that. So for the inclusivist, the problem with inclusivism is there's not a response. But the third option, exclusivism, what happens with exclusivism is we find Christians who are sure about their faith, who are sure that you have to hear the gospel or you're going to head to a Christless eternity, but they have no desire to engage the world religions, learn about them, and reach out to them. And so we find exclusivists who don't do anything. They just sit back. They have no desire to share their faith or challenge or share the gospel with people they work with. Their heart says, oh, you know, they need the gospel because they're going to go to hell if they don't have it. But they're not engaging the nations. And so I want this morning, as we walk through that door in the back, I want to offer a fourth option. I want to offer being engaged exclusivist, okay? I want to say, let's keep exclusivity. Let's keep the fact that you have to hear and respond to the gospel, and we need to share that with all nations. But what I want to do is I want all of us in this room to leave as engaged exclusivists. Now, if you want to be engaged exclusivist in today's culture, there are two things you need to do. You need to do two things if you want to be an engaged exclusivist. The first thing you need to do is you need to get engaged. You need to get engaged. We need to meet Muslims, Buddhists, and Hindus, and they're around us. We need to welcome them here. We don't need to be scared of them. When we see them at Target or across the soccer field with our kids' games, we need to go up and initiate. I mean, if I looked through your phone, am I going to see two or three people from different world religions that you're trying to impact? Or is it just going to be your friends and Pinterest? How did he know Pinterest? Has he seen my phone? Like, how did he know? Even now, I'm longing for Pinterest. I mean, am I going to see people from other faiths who you're welcoming? So the first thing we need to do is we need to get engaged. The second thing I want us to do is I want us to get informed. I want us to get informed. Now, on the screen, you're going to see five holy books from the five major world religions. I assume you already have the sixth holy book, the Bible. But as you look at these holy books, I just want to walk you through. So just let me walk you through these five. The first one is the Quran, okay? The Quran. Did you know that if you bought the Quran, it's 114 chapters. It's the exact same size as our New Testament. If you bought the Quran and read it, did you know you could talk intelligibly to 2 out of every 7 people breathing about their faith? 2 out of every 7 people would die for that holy book. Did you know if you bought the Bhagavad Gita, the holiest book for the Hindu world, it's the exact same size as our Book of Mark in our Bible? Did you know that if you bought the Bhagavad Gita and read it, you could personally talk to 950 million Hindus about their faith? Did you know that if you bought the Tao Te Ching, the holiest book for the Taoist world, who in his 20s, the author, Lao Tzu, didn't get the job he wanted, so he fled the barbarian empire. He meets a border guard, and the border guard stops him and says, are you a holy man? He writes down 192 verses. If you read 192 verses of the Tao Te Ching, you could talk intelligibly to 250 million people about their faith. Did you know if you bought the holiest book for the Buddhist world, it's called the Dhammapada. It literally translates the sayings of the Buddha. If you bought the Dhammapada, you could talk intelligibly to 650 million Buddhists about their faith. The Dhammapada is the exact same size as Ephesians. My grandmother did not need to own any of those books because she never crossed paths with a Muslim, a Buddhist, or a Hindu. Today, if you do not own those and have not read them, you're ministering like it's 1940. You're already obsolete. How can you tell me to read your holy book when you haven't even cracked mine? Think about that. We need to get informed. We need to get engaged. I love this passage in Acts 17. Let me just read it to you. In Acts 17, this is Paul the apostle, and he's ministering to people from other faiths. And here's what he says. Acts 17, men of Athens, I see that in every way you're very religious. So the first thing Paul the apostle does when he encounters other religions is this. Ready? Here it is. Here it is. He compliments them. I see that in every way you're very religious. For as I walked around, I looked carefully. He was looking for inroads to share the gospel. And then in Acts 17, he says, I even found an altar with this inscription to an unknown God. Now what you worship is something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you. And then he does this, watch this. He says, men of Athens, even in your holy book, the Epitomides, it says this, in him we live and move and have our being. We are his offspring, as even your holy books say, as even your poets have said. Paul the apostle, when he was encountering people from other faiths, he compliments them. Women, that's you at Target, and you look at a Muslim and you say, thank you for your standard of modesty. You look carefully at your object. You're looking for ways to meet and share the gospel with them. And then finally, you're actually, it's okay to memorize two or three verses out of the Quran and quote them to Muslims. I mean, chapter 3 of the Quran is the Jesus chapter. In chapter 3 of the Quran, it says Jesus was born of a virgin, that he healed many, raised the dead to life, healed the blind and the leper, and that there's nowhere he's buried today that he was taken. And in chapter 3, he will return. Think about that. Think about that. We were at the library in Fayetteville, Arkansas, where I'm from, and here I am. There's a Muslim woman, and my wife starts to talk to her. We invite them over the next week to dinner, and the wife and her husband, Haider, and their two children come into my home, and we have dinner together. And over dinner, I say to Haider, the husband, Haider, what is your favorite chapter in the Quran? And he says, what? And I said, what is your favorite chapter in the Quran? And he says, I don't know. Why? And I said, I love chapter 3 in the Quran. And we just talked about Jesus for the rest of dinner. I've had about 10 different conversations with Haider. They're all about him looking in the Quran about where Jesus is. And then I said, you know, we actually have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and that's the story of who Jesus is. It's called the Gospels. Can I give it to you? So what I want you to know as we conclude in prayer is this. All roads do not lead to Christ, but Christ can be found walking on all the roads. Will you engage people who look, act, and pray completely different than you in order that you might reach the nations? And this afternoon, from 12:30, right after service, we're going to go from 12:30 to 3:15. We're going to look at how you can practically engage Muslims, Buddhists, and Hindus. If you come back from 12:30 to 3:15, you will leave here knowing more about ministering to other nations than anybody else you know. And so, Father, we want to be people who are engaged exclusivists, people who see the world, and people who we see people we work with, who we're surrounded with, Lord. I just pray this week even, there'd be some practical opportunity where we can reach out to the nations even here or overseas. We ask this in your name. Amen.